Hello and welcome to Times Talk. This will be the last episode of the year. And this will be a different episode because this time we're meeting the people who make the news, who lead the news, our editors here at Times of Malta. So I welcome here with us today Editor-in-Chief Herman Grech, News Editor Diana Cacciattolo. Sorry. This is what happens when you're speaking to your bosses. You get nervous. Online editor Bertrand Borch and print editor Anthony Manduka. Thank you very much for joining us. The subject is a look back on this year. What were the most impactful stories for the country? What were the most impactful stories for you personally? I really am interested in what impacted you as individuals, because we're also people making the news. We have feelings. Sometimes the news affects us in ways maybe not everybody understands or expects. And what do you think will be the big news next year? What people should look out for? Also, I'd like to ask you later, what were the biggest ethical dilemmas you faced as editors during this year? What were the hardest stories to cover, even if it didn't look like it on the outside? And whether we as journalists faced pressure that people out there don't know about. Pressure to not publish stories or to publish stories a certain way. Okay, so my first question is, if you had to name one single story that you think was the most impactful for the country this year, what would it be?
So. You start, Diana. Come on. You're the one who's leading the news.
Okay. Well, I'm going to preface this by saying that I don't think 2025 was the most historic year. We've had some huge years in the last few years. So 2019 with the political crisis, we had a pandemic in 2020, an election in 2022, former prime minister being hauled into court in 2024. So all of that looks like 2025 was a very quiet year. So thinking of a particular story that's going to be something that people will remember 2025 for, it's a bit tricky, actually. So mine's maybe a little bit of a offbeat one, because if it comes to fruition, I think the transformation of Manuel Island into a national park will be the story that will make 2025 the year to remember for that reason. Because if it happens, you know, it's quite a major event. Obviously, there are a lot of promises. And in Ireland, where I'm from, there's a phrase, there's many a slip between the cup and the lip. So you make a promise, but do you actually deliver it? And we'll see that maybe in the next year or so. What do you think, Herman?
It wasn't a big year in terms of news in Malta. But I think internationally, it was an earthquake, you know? I mean, we started off with the election of Donald Trump. I will not go into what he's done, what he hasn't done. I think he just opened the news daily. Obviously, Russia-Ukraine war is still raging. It's horrible that, you know, we're getting to the end of 25 and it's still raging. But also there's been a lot of stuff happening which should directly impact us, even though it's not happening in Malta. Because there is, you know, I think there are countries where democracy is at stake. There is a siege against freedom of speech in a number of countries. And it's something which is definitely going to be, we're going to be reporting on in 26. So I will pass on to Bert and Anthony, because obviously there were other stories, but for me, the biggest news happened beyond our shores.
Anthony, I believe, has some opinions about Trump. What is so wrong about Trump?
Anthony? I think we had Donald Trump, and everything we thought would happen happened. I think us in the media, who warned about the dangers of a second Trump presidency were proved correct. I mean, he's undermined the rules-based world order, he's undermined NATO, he's undermined institutions, both at home and internationally. He's said very clearly that he hates the European Union and he'd like to see it dissolve. So it's been quite a volatile year internationally. Locally, I personally, somebody who's sort of likes to follow local politics a lot, I think the leadership change in the Nationalist Party was big news. I think there have been, as we all know, there have been rumblings for the past 5 years that sort of Bernard Grech wasn't making any inroads. The polls were very clear. I think he did the right thing when he stepped down. I think with the leadership of Alex Borg, the nationalists have a chance, if not winning the election, the next election, at closing the gap.
How do you expect Alex Borg to do?
Yeah, okay. So I think there are two main issues. One, I think the Nationalist Party needed a charismatic leader with good communication skills. I think they've got that. That's mission accomplished. But that's the easier part. Obviously, the more difficult part is convincing voters that sort of, you know,
they're good enough.
The economy will continue to grow with a nationalist government, will have the same standard of living, but at the same time, they can improve things. Because I think there is a general feeling of change in the country. Change is needed. Many people feel that. But obviously, there are concerns about the infrastructure, about the famous overpopulation, the lack of investment. And so that's what they have to do. They've got to convince the electorate that
there'd be a better government.
There'll be a better government. They'll maintain the subsidies on the utilities, the economic growth will continue, standards will continue, but at the same time, they're going to make inroads in changing the environment, in doing something about the overpopulation, overtourism.
Which is not really an easy hard, battle. Which is really difficult.
Because the economy is what it is.
Yes, because to reduce the number of people in the country and to also, at the same time, continue to grow the economy, it's a bit tricky.
That's a challenge.
I don't understand how PN can do that.
Especially overnight.
Because
people expect it to happen overnight. Locally, I think the longest running piece of news might not have been the most interesting to people, but I think the one that will impact people 10, 15 years down the road is the sale of HSBC. Mm-hmm. Assuming it goes through, in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, people will be banking with Credia Bank or whatever they decide to call themselves. And the decisions this bank will make will impact people's lives in an incredible way. And in the same way in which people still talk about the sale of MidMed Bank, and that happened 20 years ago, they might still be talking about the sale of HSBC in the 20 years to come.
Obviously, there were other big stories, Mark. I mean, we're obviously seeing it in the global context here.
Yes, of course.
Because when you consider that the trial of the Maksars, the people who allegedly built the bomb which blew up Daphne Caruana Galizia, that was obviously closing one critical chapter of this tragedy. And what we saw throughout the year, I would say, is a growing awareness of what's happening out there in the streets. So it goes from the way we drive, the way we love breaking the rules in Malta, complete to what can we really start doing to resolve this, or at least try to calm down this traffic problem. And I think for the first time, I've seen an effort, not necessarily by the government, but people out there are saying, we really need to start doing something about this, because we are reaching gridlock. And so constantly throughout the year, we have been reporting these stories, which have really made an impact. And the readers, obviously, traffic impacts everybody in one way or another.
Do you want to know what our readers thought was the best and biggest story of the year?
Of course we do.
So just before I came on, I looked at our stats for online, and there was one story that had the most views in 2025 that we have not spoken about. What do you think it was?
No idea.
Online editor?
What was it?
What the most views?
The most views, the story that was read the most by our readers this year.
This year?
Mm-hmm.
One particular story.
One story that we haven't talked about yet.
Passport scheme?
The Patchville building collapse.
Really?
Which, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a funny one, actually, because that happened on I think it was a Wednesday night.
What do you mean funny?
Funny. It was just, it just happened. We did very well with that story. We managed to tell that story quite well, or better than the competition, by sheer coincidence, because I happened to be around, it happened late. 10, 11 p.m., I can't remember, at a time when usually it would be quite hard to find someone to do the legwork.
but I happened to be working. I think my daughter couldn't sleep, or I can't remember what happened. But I was at a computer when the moment that came in. So we were quite quick. And because, and I mean, that story is a good example of how the internet has changed our job. Because within minutes, besides all the, of course, all the video footage and the photos and the very, like, you could actually see what happened, right? But within minutes, we could work out where the site was, what, who it belonged to, what permits were going on, where that there was development next door. We could look at all the documentation that had been filed with the as part of the PA application and so on and so forth. So it allowed us to kind of build the story and kind of get a broader picture of the story. And from that documentation, I managed to find the architects involved and reach out to the architects involved. And one of them told me, oh, you know, we just evacuated the residents that morning. You know, so that suddenly it's like this was a near tragedy, could have been a total disaster.
But do you think so many people read that story, Bert, because it happened in Parcherville, because it happened, you know, you came up with the detail, yes, right away about people being evacuated that morning? Would this have created so much interest? Because this is interesting to get to know this just now. Would it have created so much interest if this building happened, I don't know.
So it was a building in Salsafi or whatever.
In Safi.
Yeah, probably not, right?
Yeah.
Probably Parcherville has all these connotations,
yeah,
with it. And it's like it's our Vegas, you know? It's like our temple of greed, or of economic power. And these building collapses have become a bit of an allegory for this kind of dark side, seedy side of Malta in a way. So it was like this marriage of these two underbellies of society, you know?
And I wonder too, the recent fatal building collapses, John Paul Sophia, a couple of years ago in Merriam Patch, whether that would have been people's minds as somebody died, yeah, in this latest one. Yeah. But yeah, it was surprising to me as well. Yeah. Alex Borge came second.
And people obviously are, whenever there is, there are these accidents, you know, nowadays we have the means to communicate to our readers that something happened. We introduced push notifications this year. So automatically it comes on your mobile phone, something's happened, you delve deep. And what surprises me is with there is really a 24-hour news cycle these days. And because of online, I have seen some of the biggest figures of our website this year at midnight, 1 a.m. I mean, the Alex Borge election,
just
which I had
dragged into the early hours. Yeah.
1 a.m. typing.
1 a.m. I went to sleep at 6 a.m. because I was running a live blog. And at one point,
slightly more civilized than
I. Could you remind people what happened?
So basically, there was the election between Alex Borge and Adrian D'Elia. And we knew it could be close. Nobody envisages there's going to be a gap of just 44 votes. So, you know, you start getting indications from both camps. Oh, we're doing well. Oh, it might be close. Oh, it's going to be really close. And I remember at around 1 a.m, I remember Anthony has the print deadline. We extended.
Which was extended till 1.
Exactly.
So I went to bed.
What is the print deadline?
The
Anthony, what is the print
deadline? Without a winner.
No, what is the print deadline?
Well,
those who don't know,
it can be extended. If need be, it can be extended.
So this is
midnight.
The absolute latest you can send the newspaper for
case,
print.
In this case, we actually sent it to print at 1 a.m.
Because otherwise, the printers wouldn't have enough time to churn out the copies, and they won't be.
That is hours later than the usual deadline, right?
Many more hours.
But so this was way
past.
A normal
deadline is 9 or 9 p.m., for example. Can be extended.
So while Anthony had the luxury to go to sleep at 1 a.m, guess who had to do a live blog throughout the entire night?
We know you did.
Because
you told us about it for days on end.
I had to, because it was ridiculous.
I had the privilege of being on leave.
I wasn't working that night.
No,
either.
Joking apart, but this is the way the nature of the job, because we did have somebody on site there. but the Nationalist Party decided to lock them in a room and
give them no information.
Show them a television, which was ridiculous, frankly. So we had to get it from sources of what was really happening behind the scenes. Were they going to declare a winner? Weren't they? And when at 3 a.m, you realize that there are not hundreds, but thousands of people on your website following closely, and you can't just abandon ship. News is a 24-hour news cycle these days.
I mean, it's the first time, I've covered many PN election campaigns, the first time we closed the paper with no winner. There was no winner. We couldn't declare a winner. It was so close.
So the paper the next day didn't declare a winner?
No, we said how close it was, and, but there was no winner.
To me, what's very interesting about all of this is that I think there was another story apart from the Pacheville collapse, and now I'm thinking about it, that really captured people's imagination, which was the Ta'ali grass. And this is a story that shouldn't have captured that much attention because it is essentially about grass,
land.
That's a patch of land, about grass that's growing or not growing. Very simple and very, very inconsequential in many ways, or unconsequential, how do you say it?
Inconsequential.
In many ways. But to me, these two stories show, kind of reveal, the greatest fears people have right now in the country, which is the building boom will collapse figuratively and because people are afraid in their homes because of the way construction sites are being built. And people are buying property. And if it collapses, then I think that's one of the biggest lurking fears in the country. The second is, what if we won't have any more greenery? Again, figuratively and metaphorically, I think this is so interesting. These two stories are, in my opinion, revealed this lurking fear in people's, in the national psyche. What if we're losing it? Mm-hmm. And I think there is this, we don't talk a lot about it, but I think it's there. I'm impressed by it. I mean, especially by the Ta'ali story, which turned into a meme and into a joke and everything. But still, the attention, it either tells you this or either tells you that the country is doing so well that our problem is the grass. It could, I know that's what government is saying when they walk around. That's what they're telling our international counterparts as well. You know, in our country right now, the biggest problem is the grass. I mean, you have unemployment. We don't have unemployment. You have the economy is being decided. We don't have that. We have the grass. Anyway, so this is what really, really, really impacted me this year.
Yeah, I think you're right.
In my opinion, my biggest, the most significant story for Malta, I think 20, 30, 50, 100 years down the line, is the Latnia discovery. I know it's not as big as the ones you mentioned, but I think that really changed. That changed history forever.
And like you had written, school books.
Right? It's very significant because it takes us back. It makes us much richer than we already thought we were.
Yeah.
Well, you can tell us about it, Mark. You reported it.
Hey, do you want me to say more?
Tell. Okay.
I'll say more. I said, because my job here is to ask the question.
You want
to
swap the roles?
No, it's okay. So this was a story. This was a really interesting story. So often when researchers speak to us, it's often a really difficult subject to understand.
Complex.
A really complex study that you really need to go through. So when we first, you got the story and you assigned it to me, Herman. And when I first heard, I said, oh, it's another study. Okay, this will be hours of going through a detailed document, trying to find a headline, trying to find something to lead with. But when I contacted them, they said, this is, and it was immediate. It immediately felt very big to me. Mm-hmm. The story was that a discovery in a cave, in a beautiful, I had never been there, I say shamefully, in Latnia, discovered that. So initially we always thought, that's what we always studied at school, that the first people in Malta were farmers. And those aren't the first people to ever live on land. Everybody knows that the first people to ever roam the earth were foragers, hunters and gatherers. And we thought Malta never had those. And the hunters and the gatherers are the earliest, most primitive human beings we know of, as in of our species. And this discovery, these scientists, it was led by multi scientists, but it was a team of international scientists, discovered that our history goes back at least 9,000 more years, which means there were hunter gatherers here, which is to me phenomenal, impressive. Now I need to ask the next question. Sorry, I forgot about it. So, but aside from national importance, which story impacted you the most personally? Which you lost sleep over, or which really touched you in a good or bad way, whatever.
I think this year has been a year that there have been a lot of tragedies involving children. Mm-hmm. So we've had two young boys dying in pool drownings. There was that father and son who died in a drowning incident in Ramla Bay. But I think the story that sort of stuck with me and was incredibly difficult to handle was the death of the baby boy in the car in Mater Dei. And I had never come across a story like this actually in my 18 years in journalism. So we heard some very scant details about this case in October, where a baby boy was found dead in a car in Mater Dei, and that was really about all that we were told by the police. And obviously we broke the story. It was quite late in the evening, and I remember Daniel Elul was on one side of the newsroom and you, Herman, were on the other, and you were both speaking to your sources about trying to understand what had happened. And as the information came through, you could just feel the energy in the room sort of being sucked out. So in this story, we found out some tragic details, and we had to then figure out what do we actually tell the people about this, because it's a very difficult personal story, but also it's a national story at the same time. And we decided that we would give some details in terms of the fact that sadly one of the parents had thought that she'd dropped off her son to a childcare centre, but actually had gone to work, and at the end of the day when she went to pick him up had realised that actually she'd left him in the car. And it was just a really sad, tragic story, but we felt we needed to give those details, because obviously if people were to hear about a child dying in a car, they may think of all sorts of other explanations for that, and we felt that the truth of those details was important to give people an understanding that this was, you know, just a tragic story. And I remember speaking to one of our journalists, Sarah Carbot, who's a mother herself, and she said that this was forgotten baby syndrome, or she mentioned forgotten baby syndrome. And again, I'd never heard of this before, but when we started to look into it, we saw that actually this type of thing has happened before, mostly in hot countries, so in Australia and parts of the US, and in really surprisingly similar scenarios where a child is, the parent thinks they've left the child at childcare and actually have left them in the car. So we thought then we should educate the public about this, and we were trying, I think, to hold the public's hand through this story without overstepping the privacy of the family who are dealing with such an incredible tragedy. And this had come just a couple of, I think, weeks after another major tragedy for Malta.
And what Diana's mentioning over here is sometimes, you know, we forget, maybe readers forget, that behind the headlines are people, human beings writing. You know, there are parents here among us, there are people who are very sensitive to certain issues. We are not robots. You know, we might act like, you know, we're they're churning out stories, but behind every headline, there's a person writing it who goes home at the end of the day and has to hold his baby at the end of the day and realizing what could have happened. In my case, I think the one story which really impacted me was the Croatia crash, because it was horrific for Maltese people on holiday, longtime friends. Something happened in a curve in Croatia and a car plummeted into the sea and the four of them died, drowned. Now that impacted us most because of the circumstances which led to the information going out there, because we got to know pretty early in the day about what had happened. From our sources, you know, we speak to each other, we speak to other journalists, Croatian journalists were contacting us and we were contacting them. And there was a moment, it still gives me goosebumps, because at one point Diana called me over and she said, okay, the families are reaching out to us because they're calling their loved ones in Croatia and they're not picking up the phone. You know, and it is a horrible feeling.
I think it's important to note that this was not
an hour after the crash.
Oh, no, no, this happens the
next day.
This is the next day.
Right.
And we just reported because it was out in the Croatian media. I mean, it was a public knowledge. And the families were asking us whether we knew it was them, their loved ones. And, you know, in the next few hours, I had to make some of the most difficult phone calls of my life because I was communicating with the family. Obviously, we'd had scant information, but my goodness, the families were a desperate formation, but they handled the tragedy. My goodness, I have nothing but good words to say about their children, their siblings, the way they dealt with it, the way they, obviously, they were grieving, they were shocked, and then the grief. But that impacted me a lot because, I mean, one of the victims, I remember him, was a friend of my brother, you know. So this is, again, the proximity of Malta where we all tend to know each other. And then over the next few days, you know, getting to know the story of how these two couples just went abroad together. And my God, we all travel. We all drive abroad. It's what happened to any of us. And you are there trying to... Again, detach yourself from the emotion, but it's impossible when you're speaking to one of the family members who is desperate on the phone trying to get information. And you forget about, I forgot about the story at one point. And people do not realize how sensitive we are when there is something like this. We knew the identity by late morning because the family themselves. But until we knew that the next of kin were all informed about the death and what had happened, we did not publish the name. You know, this is a discussion we have in the newsroom on a daily basis. Until the next of kin is informed, we will not provide the details.
So the relatives don't learn from us. Yes.
And this was where it's usually a bit clear. It's a bit it's easier than in this case, you know, because this case, a day passed. And the next of kin hadn't been informed, you know? So we had some difficult conversations with the authorities about this
and
in those hours.
And there were issues with the Croatian authorities too, because...
Yes. So Maltese authorities had issues with the Croatian authorities as well.
Yes, it caused obviously they more complicated.
In terms of how the Croatian authorities decide when... to confirm
someone's identity.
It was a bit of a slower pace than
you would expect. So Maltese authorities had,
But in the meantime, the Croatian media was reporting it. Mm-hmm. Without the names, but reporting for Maltese, you know.
Oh, the story was out.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think we've had such a tragedy before.
Abroad.
In our profession, abroad. So many, four people.
So many people, So four people. And again, where do you draw the line? The Croatians were publishing certain videos, certain details, which we did not publish. You need to remain as sensitive as possible to the feelings. You know that ultimately family members are going to be reading the story. So, you know, it's good to know that the readers should know that we are far more sensitive than they might think, or some of the criticism we receive on the social media.
And everybody knows who this one is and that one is. One of the victims was a friend of my brother who was a schoolmate in his class. I knew him as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, older than me, but I remember him at school. So you feel it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's terrible.
Yeah, I think in general people are, don't realize how much we choose not to publish.
Yeah,
you know. Mm-hmm. In general, but it can be something, you know, holding off publication for a few hours or days, like in this case,
or not publishing at all.
Yes, yes. Or even in certain stories, not publishing certain details. Mm-hmm. Or certain photos or certain things, whatever it is.
Yes.
You know,
people tend to believe that whatever they see is whatever comes to us.
Yeah.
Which is not the case.
Not the case.
It's a selection of it.
Not the case.
I don't know if you have a story that impacted you personally, because...
No, look, when I thought about this, when I was... The baby story, I wasn't working that day. But I was at home, and I still remember where I was when I got that notification and I saw the story. And I felt a lurch in me, you know, physical. Just horrible. It's every parent's worst nightmare, you know? Yeah, my heart goes out to them.
And one thing actually about that story is that when I spoke to working parents, young working parents, most of them said something along the lines of,
yeah,
that it could easily happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because to them.
Yeah.
Yes, yes,
I think
yes.
people are yes. they, juggling
people
so
felt
much.
Like that could be me. And I think that was the real fear that...
Yeah.
When people saw that story, I think they remembered, I'm not a parent, so I wouldn't know, but I think they remembered how many times they were stressed out and forgot this and that. Mm. They said, that could be me, yes. under the right, yeah. under wrong the circumstances. Wrong,
yeah. I mean, we know that somebody me. Who left his baby in the car but and remembered and went back.
Yep.
He went back for it.
He realized in time.
That's what I'm saying. I think yeah. people
the and went back.
Read that story and it captured their imagination because I said you could relate to.
And the other thing as well, just to maybe we'll move on from this before you depress everybody. But I think the other thing that is difficult for families is when there's a national tragedy, for the families, they only obviously care about the thing that's happening to them. And sometimes families find it difficult to understand why there should be anything in the media at all about their personal tragedy.
That's a really good question. And why should there be anything at all?
Well, I think because, I mean, there's a public interest in the case of if somebody dies unexpectedly, not a natural cause. There's a public interest in discussing that, you know, to make sure that society is working in the way that it should to protect people's lives. And I suppose that's the ultimate part of it. But, you know, I think with the Croatia tragedy, when you start to want to talk to the families about their loved ones, some family members will be very up for that, will want to celebrate. And some will say, my parents were very private people and they wouldn't want to speak. And you kind of have to, you know, let the families lead you in that way. But in terms of the kind of the details of what actually happened, there is a public interest in that.
Yep. Mine was Kyle Schembri.
Mm.
Yep. I had known about Kyle's story for a while. And whenever I had spoken to him and said, come on, Kyle, let's do an interview.
So Kyle Schembri is the former journalist. Yeah, so Kyle
former journalist. He does great work in Nigeria, I think, nowadays, with an NGO, with a human rights NGO.
In Kenya,
not Nigeria. And so his story is that when he was young, when his father was a boy, he was severely sexually abused by a priest for many years. He grew up to develop very severe mental health issues, among them depression, bipolar disorder, and paranoia. And it got so bad that it led his father to kill his mother. And the rest is a saga of going to court, going to Mount Carmel to see his father until his father died. And we knew about the story for quite a while. And whenever I spoke to Kyle off record as friends or whenever we met for coffee, he told me, I tell him, why don't you want to speak about it? And he said, I will one day, but on my own terms. And this earlier this year, he contacted you, Herman, and said, I've decided what
these
my
terms
are, and I'm going to write a fiction and novel based on the very horrific, true story of my family. And we did that interview. He was great in it. He almost sold out his book at the National Book Fair.
I went to the next weekend. The day.
Yes,
it was not
long lines. Yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah. So Merlin Library told us, Merlin Publishers, Chris Gruppetta told us, we sold all the books we took to the net, which is incredibly rare for a Maltese work of fiction.
But also,
work of fiction.
What struck me with that interview is it could have easily been sensationalized.
Yeah, you did a great job, Mark.
So that's credit to you, Mark. Carl, we all know Carl. He's a colleague, you know, he's an old friend as well. But sometimes you mentioned the word on his terms. What Carl meant there is that I am really prepared to talk about it now within the context of a book, which
yes.
he uh-huh. sold as kind of semi-fiction when we know it probably is to a large extent the truth. But it's important that it shows as well the importance of these kinds of conversations. Because let's remember, Times Talk was resuscitated again this year through a podcast. And credit to you, Mark, because you've really taken it up there already. among the most popular in the country.
And award-winning.
And
thank you.
The most important thing, however, is the media is changing. The way we're telling stories is changing. I mean, there will always be a demand for stories, but the way we're telling stories is changing. It's becoming more visual. And people, when they're stuck in traffic, are listening to these podcasts. So it's important to keep telling these stories through different mediums. And I think this is the most important thing we need to adapt to in this day and age where journalism is changing, and it's also under siege.
I have two final questions because we need to wrap up. One is, because I think people are interested in this, have we faced some sort of pressure this year to not publish a story, not to publish, or to kill a story?
Yes.
I mean, every week.
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. I mean, I think the most unusual one was a legal case where a company actually successfully took out an injunction against us to stop publishing, which had never happened before. And actually in the UK, it's not uncommon. And in fact, there are cases called super injunctions where you can't even report that there's an injunction out against a particular story. Celebrities use these or have done so in the past, at least. But it is unheard of in Malta. So
what had happened in that case?
Maybe,
with
Herman,
case?
You want to pick up that story?
No, in this case, one of our journalists, Jacob Borch, basically sent questions to the company.
To a financial institution, right?
And
instead of answering the questions, they went to court and they basically asked the court to prohibit us from publishing anything as a result of those questions. And the court upheld it provisionally, but thankfully it overturned the injunction when it actually looked at the merits. And
the story was published.
The story was published.
About a month later, yes. But it was, I've never seen it in 28 years. It's never happened.
I mean, rather than it, in this case, it wasn't really about the story itself, which was a story.
Yes, we do these stories all the time.
Yeah,
no, exactly. It wasn't the biggest story.
Exactly.
Of
But it's about the implications of that, of that injunction, right?
Because it could be used.
It could be used as a weapon.
Had the court not overturned it, it would have set a precedent.
Yeah.
For these subjects of our stories to weaponize it against the media.
But I mean that you have to we get pressure not to publish.
Yes, even
pretty
on,
much
on
every
the
day.
Yes, on the
right?
phone and over WhatsApp.
But there's obviously you have to distinguish between pressure from an upset mother because her son was in court.
Yes, which we do
and,
get.
And a financial institution or
a politician
or whatever. Yeah.
Or a company.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, I think we don't really get that much pressure from politicians not to publish within.
No, I mean, you will get
most of them understand
blowback, right?
that's how it works. Yes.
Now, what upset me with this particular company is that in this case, Jacob did his job. He got the information and he went to them for a reaction, because that's what all media companies should do. You always seek a reaction before you publish. And in this case, they didn't even say wait or whatever. They just went straight to court, which I think is a bit unfair. And if we go down this route, and thankfully the court saw sense in this, if we go down this route, it would be a very dark day for the media. And for public interest.
Thankfully, it doesn't look like we're going down that route.
No.
So as far now.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we started, we said we agreed we'd make this light.
Yes.
Because everything is about light.
Final
question. Which story from this year, in your opinion, is a critical piece of unfinished business that needs to be addressed in 2026?
I think it's the planning bills.
I agree.
Because the laws are so controversial, giving minister extra powers, giving the planning authority extra powers. People already are under the impression that the planning authority is God, these laws will make, will remove the court's power to step in, or will water that down at least. There's a huge lack of trust in the authority and the ministry. And I think, I mean, we saw people on the street protesting, which has become quite a common occurrence, actually. But I think that is going to be the issue in the first few months of 2026. Of course, you can't really predict things because some buildings...
Unless we have an early election.
You still believe there will be an early election? Because
I've heard that it hasn't been ruled out. I know that the Prime Minister was quite categorical to you, Herman, but...
No, I don't believe there will be an early election next year.
I don't know.
I believe it will...
I think he hasn't made up his mind yet.
No, things could change. But I think if I had to bet on it, and we've made bets before, Anthony, and I won during the Trump election.
Unfortunately, Trump won.
Yes. I think it'll be in 2027. No, but
obviously the political side is unfinished because you never know. Plus, what's going to happen? The National Party has a new leader. I think we all agree that there is excitement around Alex Borch. So, but does it mean people or the polls, surveys? I mean, let's face it, Labour are still ahead in all the polls. So it's up to the Prime Minister to see when he wants to go for the election, because ultimately it's up to him. He has up to March 27 to go for the election. But
I mean, does he call it now and win it because the polls are saying he's going to win, or does he risk, you know, prolonging it and maybe Borch will gain more strength or not.
Or maybe he'll
make mistakes and then, you know,
go back.
Does
he allow Borch to kind of plateau then go there?
You know, because there's calculations.
Because there's always a sort of sell-by date on the excitement of a new thing.
True.
And, you know, Alex Borch is new and exciting for his supporters forever. And he won't be in a year's time. To that extent.
So that's obviously something to consider on that one.
Can I take it away from politics? One story which kind of I think is maybe a bit of a metaphor for like unfinished business is the story about car drivers being offered €25,000 to give up their license, which was this big headline promise of the government back in spring. And they said, we'll do it by summer. And now we're in winter and it's been watered down, but even the watered down version hasn't happened. It's starting in January now. It's starting in January for young people.
Yes, 18 to 30 year olds.
I remember when we were writing the first story, I spoke to a high ranking official to confirm that this, Daniel Elul had gotten the rumor, gotten wind of this plan. And I made some phone calls to try and understand what was, and they confirmed. And my first reaction was like, this is crazy because everyone's going to want to give it in. And they said, no, it's not going to be that popular. And then it turned out that they were surprised by how many people were keen to do this. So they had to completely scale it back and focus on young people because it would have bankrupted them. But I think in general, it's a bit of a metaphor for the us kicking the can down the road on transport, on traffic. You know, I live in the south and every year I see it getting worse and worse and worse. The government's own strategies and policies kind of make it clear that if nothing is done by 2030, that southern like Marsa Hamrun bypass will be gridlock. Mm-hmm. And nothing, there doesn't, I mean, there's talk of plans and policies. I know you spoke to the transport minister recently, Mark, would be releasing, yes, maybe by the time this is out.
He does have plans.
Yeah, but what was the expression, Di? The Irish expression?
There's many a slip between the cup and the lip.
There you go. Right?
Yes, we'll have to see.
Yeah, the plans are, in the cup.
Yes.
And yet we're
what I'm really
it.
Curious about is the baby tax cut. Clyde Caruana's, because that we really need to see how that will play out.
Yes.
Will more people make babies to get the tax cut or not? Because that's crucial for the country, crucial for Clyde's career, I believe.
I think it will only work if they follow it up
it won't work on its own.
That's
right.
Fair enough. I know what you mean.
So like if in five years' time they'll have introduced a variety of other measures which make it much easier to have a child and raise a child, then I think maybe you can say. Yeah, but in isolation, I don't think
most people agree that it's not going to work on its own. They need a series of measures, flexi work, etc.
I hope it works, though. I really hope it works.
Of course,
it's got me thinking about making babies.
You heard it here first.
But your partner would be delighted to hear it.
I know.
But your question was like, "Oh, we're talking depressing and stuff." There's a lot of humor that goes out and that happens in this room. Whoever was watching this program, this podcast, there's a lot because sometimes you need a lot of humor to cope with a day's work. And the one thing I think, which was a bit of an eye-opener even for someone like me this year, was the way, again, go back to the way we tell the news. So just a couple of weeks ago, we had this feature where we were all forced, apart from me, because I wasn't even told about it, to catch the bus to come to work. And the numbers on the numbers of people who watch that video is insane on every platform. And it really got me thinking, because that is probably something that probably my former editors would have disapproved of, that the journalist should be part of the story. But I think increasingly people are realizing, we are realizing, myself included, that the journalists need to be seen as human beings, that they are the ones telling the stories and they are impacted on day-to-day problems. So a simple thing like catching the bus, at first I kind of scoffed at the idea, but then I was proven wrong, because people are saying, okay, you know, we discovered that it might take you longer from certain areas. We discovered that Mark Lawrence never bothered to catch a bus in his life.
There are no pavements.
Yeah, but also, it put a bit of perspective to do what we do, because we're not just here sitting behind a desk and really just taking phone calls and writing stories. We are part of the news. This is why I keep encouraging people to come to us and speak to us about anything. We're far more approachable than you think. That includes you.
You're probably too approachable, am I?
Yes, it's true. On that note, unless you have anything else to say, on that note, wishing you a wonderful, peaceful, happy, and healthy new year to you and to our loyal audience who has been following this podcast since it started a few months ago. We'll see you next year. We'll see you on Time Stock next year, and I'll see you probably tomorrow at work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.